podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to Ironcast, and welcome to one of my childhood favourites.
Well, that's made me sound old.
Yeah.
And he says it every week, by the way.
No, this is how much I loved you, Don. I got a Letra set. Do you remember Letra
set,
the little names? And on my wall in my childhood bedroom, I wrote Don Hutchison
nice.
On the wall. And it was there for about 10 years. I think
amazing.
It covered both spells, actually.
I had a poster of you on my wall.
Did you?
Liverpool poster.
Oh, my days.
Back in the day, yeah.
So that
loving
fans.
This.
Welcome to Ironcast, Don Hutchison. Man, I'm so excited to have you here. I wanted to begin by talking about your time at Liverpool. I wanted to check a story.
Go on.
I interviewed Steve McManaman, and he told me that Graeme Souness kind of built this team of, I want to say, nutters.
Yeah.
Like, he was building it in his own image at Liverpool. And he signed Julian Dix, of course, which we'll talk about.
And Ruddock.
Ruddock as well, I mean. And I heard that Souness said to you, look, Don, you're not in my plans, really, this season.
Yeah.
And then there was a players versus kind of staff game, and you sent in a crunching tackle on Souness.
Two-footed him.
And he stood up and said, right, you're in the team now.
Yeah, it's slightly more long-winded than that. He wanted to swap me for Tim Flowers down at Southampton, the goalkeeper. So he wanted to swap me. The Southampton manager was a guy called Ian Branfoot, who's from Gateshead, where I was from. So there's a sort of little bit of a connection there. And I didn't want to go because Southampton were like always bottom three, bottom four, five. Inevitably, were going to go down at some stage. I just thought, if I go there, they're going to go down. So I didn't go. So Sui then put on a 6v6, picked himself in one team and put me on another team because he was going to crunch me. So, like sod's law, games going on, ball right between me and Sui. He's come in two-footed. I know he's going to do me. I've sort of sensed it. I've gone higher and two-footed him.
Wow. Right?
Like a cartoon sketch. We've both fell on the floor, like pow, bang, bang. He's giving it one of them, punching me in the ribs. I'm like, it's the gaffer. I'm punching him back. We're rolling. His hair's all over the place. I'm all over the place. I'm quite emotional. And he's jumped up and gone, see? That's what we need, a bit of bollocks.
Really?
He'll be in the team at the weekend.
Wow.
All the young lads, Jamie, all on the edge going, he's finished. McManaman, they're all thinking to themselves,
you're done.
He's finished. He's gone. Played on a Saturday.
He's an hard man and all, isn't he?
Sui.
He's like one of the hardest.
One of the hardest. I don't know what came over me. It was the red mist, but I knew he was going to do me. And I sort of want to say there was no malice, but there was loads of malice, only in the space of about 2 minutes. And it was brilliant. And I love him. And he gave me my debut. I played under him. One of the best managers I've ever played under, just a proper man's man, hard as nails, just give you a tap on the backside when you've played well. Didn't need any fluff, didn't need to tell you you were brilliant or you played well today. If you were crap, he'd give you it. And if you played well, he'd just go, well played.
Yeah, you played 45 times for Liverpool around that
loved
era,
it.
Mainly under Souness.
Loved it. I'd have played a lot more if I was a lot more disciplined off the pitch, shall we say.
Well, this was, I'd love to talk to you about this because there was always the rumour that you were a bad boy. But
no,
it never went any further than that.
No, do you know what I was? And Ginge might have been the same. I was the kid in school that always got caught. Right, so all the troubles going on, right? And you're looking on the edge and you go, I fancy a little bit of that. And then you get involved, caught.
Yeah.
Caught. I was the kid at school that always got caught. And at Liverpool, sad to say really, because I do put my head on the pillow at night time. And I do think, I wonder if I would have been there longer if I and the team had behaved a lot better. But it was the culture at the time.
Yeah.
The culture in the 90s was like, you play hard and you work hard. And that was it. I mean, none more so when I signed for West Ham and you come down here and you've got Faces, Country Club, Charlie Chan's, City Limits, The Castle. Like the early 90s was like gold dust down here. Just for young lads enjoying yourselves. It's just amazing.
Can't remember anything of the West Ham games, but you remember
every
pub and club in Essex at the time. Brilliant.
We should say we're here at Chadwell Heath Training Ground, which is where you trained. You said like, and they're pulling in. You hadn't been here for 20 years.
20 years. And I've seen the pitch out. Nothing's changed on the outside in terms of where the pitches were and the layout. A lot have changed inside because it was all porter cabins. The gym was a porter cabin. Everything, the canteen, secretary's office, all just porter cabins, just all just joined together. But the early 90s here was like, it's an amazing place to be. Like the characters in the dressing room were like off the charts. Like you couldn't fail every single day to come in and have a laugh. And you've got no idea what's going to happen.
I say it all the time. Did you quite like it when it was, I know it's lovely, football's changed a lot since we played, but did you like it when it was porter cabins? It had that feel about it, didn't it?
Yeah, it was,
I just used to love the feel around the place.
The lads made it though. Early 90s here, you had people like Alvin Martin, Martin Allen, Ian Bishop, Trevor Morley, Julian Dix, Kenny Brown. Like the list of great lads, like we were just amazing lads to be around. You had to be on your guard because there's like a little hierarchy because you're young. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? You can't just step into like Alvin Martin or Ian Bishop and Trevor Morley, John Moncur, Ian Bishop's world straight away. So there's a hierarchy, isn't there? You know what it's like when you go and you're a young player. You've got to like earn the respect. You've got to earn like your time. And then all of a sudden you're one of them players and the young lads like Michael Hughes or Keefe Rowland start coming in and the young lads that were from the academy. So it's just like this, not revolving door, but it's just, I love the fact that you had to, you couldn't just bowl in somewhere and be the top man.
Like earn your stripes.
Yeah, exactly that.
When you came to West Ham, Julian Dix was actually at Liverpool. He had like 93, 94. You spent that season together. So when you knew the move to West Ham was on, did you speak to Julian about West Ham or how did that?
Yeah, so I ended up living with Julian up in Liverpool, him and his wife Kay. And I don't know if you ever met Julian or spent time with Julian. Julian's got no time for humans. Right? Dogs are his passion. Doesn't trust humans. But once you get in Julian's little circle and you're one of his mates, he'll love you forever. And it's just the way he is. Some people think he's arrogant. He's not. He's actually quite shy.
Yeah, he is quite shy. I was going to say he's quite shy and reserved, isn't he?
Yeah. But animals was his passion. He had kennels, looked after dogs. When I was with Julian up in Liverpool, you're correct, and we both come down to West Ham. I think he lived down in Billericay Way somewhere at the time. And I loved him. And he let me into his little five or six people of friendship because he was... He couldn't stand any sort of waffle or any crap. Just like if you're his mate, you're his mate, and if you're not, you're not. And if you're not his mate, it's fine. He just won't spend any time with you.
Yeah.
But like that's cool. If I'm not Ginger's mate, I'm not gonna text him every 5 minutes. Mm. Or if I'm your mate, you know what I mean, if you're not, you're not. Julian was one of them where he was just a little bit complex in terms of if you're in a team, you want to be his mate, but if he doesn't want to let you in, he's not gonna let you in.
Martin Allen tells these stories of like being on away trips and sat there reading a book and Julian would just come on and take the book out of hand and rip it in half.
Or set it on fire.
Or set it
He sounds quiet, doesn't he?
or his favourite was Nick the Back Page. You do all the book and you've got no ending.
Was it? It was Wardy telling the story about when they roomed together and Julian put an iron on him.
Probably.
I mean, it don't sound.
A complex individual might be an understatement.
But you know what, though? The 90s, that was a brutal time to play footy.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
It was. You must have had one when someone's made a cup of tea and they stir the cup of tea and the spoon's boiling up and they do you on the back of the neck.
Yeah, yeah. Stick the spoon on.
Oh, my word.
You had to be on your guard.
You did.
Yeah.
Didn't you?
We've had a few on talking about how the banter and the dressing room's changed over the years, but I sort of probably caught the backer end of it.
Like
you had to be on your... Certainly, we talk about that. 2006, well, when I came and Don was still here, 2005, 2006, that banter in that dressing room was absolutely ruthless. Anything could happen at any minute.
Honestly, it's nuts.
That early spell you had at West Ham, it's funny, like, because when you think about your career, I think of you as a midfielder, but of course, when you first joined West Ham, you were a striker, really, right? You
played anywhere.
Played
anywhere. I was, I wasn't the best player in the world, but I thought one of my strengths as a player was I could play anywhere and I could problem solve. I think that's half the battle in life, I think. If you can solve some problems, if the manager wants you to play right back, we'll figure it out. Everyone's inside you. If you play midfield, you got to do it. If you're a number 10, number 10, 9, 9. Like, it's not rocket science when you play football.
It sound very easy though, mate.
I'm not saying I was amazing at it. I mean, I played loads of games. I remember being at Everton quite a few times and I played as a number 10. And everyone think like a number 10 is like the easiest position in the world. I've had games where wherever I ran on the pitch, I was nowhere near the ball.
Yeah.
Because number 10 is quite hard. You've got to be like, you've got to have a sense of where the build-up play is going to happen and this, that, and the other. And I've had millions of nightmares across my career, but I'd like to think I was adaptable. And someone said to me, Craig Brown, for example, we played Croatia away, Scotland, Croatia, and Prozaneski was playing, legendary Prozaneski, played at Real Madrid, Barcelona, like this legendary player, sort of Zidane for the younger players who don't know who he was. And Craig Brown said to me, can you do me a job today? And I'm going, go on. He went, can you man-mark someone for me? And I went, man-mark someone? I went, like, I've never man-marked anyone in my life. He went, go on. And I've gone, go on then who? And he went, Prozaneski. And I've gone,
thanks for that.
It's like marking, like man-marking Zidane. And I remember saying to him, yeah, how hard can it be? Stand on someone, stop them from playing. Ripped me to shreds. Took me all over the pitch. Like, walked me into right back. Walked me into left back. So there were spaces in midfield. Like a genius.
Yeah.
But like, you just get on with it.
Because he knew he was being man-marked to take you out of the game.
Yeah, but it was like, I think like the modern day, like, oh, I'm a cam or I'm number six or I'm number four. I'm a right. Like 90s was like, play where the gaffer wants you to play.
Yeah, exactly.
What are you going to say? No?
Where would you see yourself modern day? Where would you say your position would be nowadays?
Harjinge, because I've played everywhere, and I always thought I was a number eight midfield player, but I was never the quickest. Mm. I was a cross country runner, so I could run for fun. And I remember going to Sunderland, and I signed for Reedy, Peter Reed at Sunderland from Everton, and he went, you haven't got the legs to get up and down midfield. He went, but you got good brain, football brain. He went, playing you on the right hand side. Scored like 15 goals, like couldn't stop getting chances. It was all down to Niall Quinn, who played up front through the middle, and Kevin Phillips. And I played on the right side. Julio Arca played on the left. And every time the ball went long, you just use your brain, get off Quinny's knockdowns, get chances.
Yeah.
But I'd like to think middle of the park.
You sound like you would have been quite an easy player to manage. Does that make sense? As in like...
That's not your reputation, I think. No, it's fair to say.
I mean, is it on the pitch, maybe?
Yeah, maybe on the pitch.
Say give you a job, you're doing it, wherever you play.
100% that.
Yeah.
But if you are not picking me, I'm very emotional. Start crying. Why are you not playing me? Very emotional.
I'm playing goal, Gaffer.
Honestly, very emotional.
Yeah.
Honestly. Like, especially under Glenn. Me and Harry had some unbelievable battles here, like 25 years ago, like when Harry was the manager here.
Because Harry just taken over from Billy Bond, so he was relatively new as a kind of Premier League manager. Obviously, he's got a lot
of experience. And me and Jamie used to live together in Diggs. So whenever he phoned Jamie, put Don on. So I'd come on the phone for the last minute, and he was just sowing the seed. You'd love it down here. Bish, Monks, Julian, Trev, London. You'd love it. And no, I'm happy. And then all of a sudden, like about 6 weeks later, after sowing the seed, or a bit longer than that, he ends up signing me.
Brilliant.
Oh, so he said this. Lovely.
Yeah.
You scored some big goals. Like, your role as a striker, I think, shouldn't be diminished. Like, I remember Chelsea in the League Cup. Do you remember this? Round three, October, I think it was 94. A diving header that I tried to replicate over the park.
Yeah, I wasn't
many
seeing
a time.
That again. I wasn't brave, though.
What do you mean?
Was it one of them, too?
It was in the first minute of the game, brave enough.
Yeah, one of them, because I knew I was going to get clattered.
Close your eyes.
That's it.
Yeah. Done a few
but the big thing about your first season at West Ham, we find ourselves in this relegation battle. And I think some of our final home games are the likes. I think we've got Manchester United final game, obviously, Blackburn, Liverpool. And we enter these final run of games needing to win. Yeah. I think Liverpool in particular, we batter them 3-0.
Nighttime
you
game, wasn't
it? You score twice. What a performance. That's the thing about West Ham. When you get into those relegation battles sometimes, just pull out unbelievable performances. And you were a big part of that
good
run.
Players, though.
Yeah,
good players.
Was a joke, wasn't it?
Like good player, like people like John Moncur and Ian Bishop, you know, like I don't know, £100 million players these days.
What?
I promise you.
Chris is quite surprised by that. Clearly.
Well, I mean, like, listen, I'm not putting Bish in the likes of Rodri or Busquets or Michael Carrick's quality, but he was unbelievable. Bish, left foot, right foot, any Ranger pass, right? He was a guy that was so good. Probably in the wrong era, same as Monks. Yeah. Like Glenn Hoddle was a player who Monks absolutely idolised. Glenn was probably the last player before Monks that was two-footed. So you know, John Moncur, like we'd play games, go, John, zing a little two-iron out there with your right foot. And he'd go, zing two-iron. I go, do on your left foot. And he goes, two-iron out there. Every pass, every range in the locker, every club. Yeah. Bish was the same. But like there were just guys who were like, these guys were so technical, but playing in the 90s where it was hard work and hard graft. Yeah. And you're playing up against people like Vinnie Jones. You're playing up against like animals in midfield. But these guys were very technical. Stick them in the modern day. Yeah. Fish amongst.
But why do you think we underachieved then in the 90s? Like when you think about
it. No, I just think it was
like,
hard.
Yeah.
90s was hard football. Yeah. 90s was, you know, well, you're a bit after that. But 90s was everyone played 4-4-2. There was no real tactics because everyone played the same tactics.
Yeah.
So it was 4-4-2. You never really got loads of instructions, loads of information. The guys these days are watching like analysis movies like all day long and you know exactly who you're playing against. 90s was like, roll your sleeves up. You're playing against Vinnie Jones, John Fashanu, right? Win the battle before you can play.
Mm.
That's 90s football. By the way, every single week, you never got an easy game in the 90s. From my memory anyway. You had to graft for your wins.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of, like, I don't know if this is grafting, but your disciplinary record at West Ham is one thing that always seemed to come up around the time. I think it was 11 bookings in 39 games and one sending off.
It's quite impressive. It's quite impressive.
I'll take that.
What was that about? Was that just, what was the disciplinary record about?
Emotional, man.
Yeah.
Like Wurzel Gummidgehead. Like, ask me to play number 10. I can dance a little bit and I can do a bit, but ask me to get stuck in, like emotional. Like
were they mostly tackles or back chat?
No, tackles. I remember one funny one. So I should have known better and it makes me laugh every single time. So I was in the Swallow Hotel, the Marriott in Waltham Abbey. That's where I sort of lived for about 6 months.
I think every new side. I was there for 6 months as well.
So we need to do a podcast there because there's some stories there.
So I was in there and Dixie came along and I think it was Martin Allen. I'm pretty sure it was Julian Dix and Martin Allen. They came along for a free steak, for a bit of food, right? And I remember, and we're chatting away. And I didn't notice it at the time, but obviously we're trying to set me up, the two of them. And we've had a meal and we're talking about West Ham and like boys are talking about the fans are going to love you. Like get stuck in. Like even if you play bad, he went, just like make sure you get stuck in. And Martin was going, yeah, they don't mind like a red card every now and again. Cause he's getting pushed out the side, isn't he? Cause I'm coming. He wants me to have a suspension so he can come back in the side. So he's going, get sent off, like rattle someone. And I swear, honestly, we played against Leicester. And you remember Mark Draper? Yeah, Mark Draper was a really, really good player. Another player in the 90s, like today would like really good player. And he'd done me with a nutmeg. So I two-footed him about a minute later in front of the dugout. I've got a yellow for a bad two-footer. My head's gone now. Like, this is me to a T. Once I get a yellow and, like, I'm on the edge, if you're managing me,
get you off.
Because I'm going, right? Drapes has done another little bit of skill. I've done him again, two-footer. Bang, red card. 3-match suspension. Martin Allen, straight back in.
Worked a treat.
How is Harry about the disciplinary record?
If you ever go back and see me get sent off against Leicester, Harry's face tells you all.
Livid.
As if like, what have I signed here?
Really?
What a
Was it early on?
Very early on.
Was it?
Must have been, because in my mind's eye, I think it was first couple of games, might have been half a dozen in, but the reason why I was asking, they were telling me about the West Ham fans, I get the sense it was early on.
Yeah. You played as well in that final game of your first season at West Ham, the Man United game where we stopped them winning the title. You were there. Like, Upton Park was electric that day. What was it like to play in that
big
game?
Big Ludo, wasn't it?
Yeah, Ludo game was on of his fire. Life. Michael Hughes? No.
Did Matty Holmes score on Michael Hughes?
Yeah, Matty Holmes, I think, crossed it. We were like madmen that day, like up for it. Wanted to stop Man U winning the league.
Nothing to play for as well.
But the history, isn't it? The Paulins and everything that goes along with it. Like when you're there, you feel like the tension. You know the history. If you watch footy from years ago, you know why West Ham ate Man United and vice versa. To get them on the last day and Liverpool are playing Blackburn to win the league at Anfield, like you can't fail to get up for it. You can't fail to want to like kick people and like have a fight and get stuck in and stop them winning the league. That's exactly what happened.
Can you remember Fergie after? Do you remember anything about it after?
I remember what he said. I think he said, these are a disgrace. They've turned up for one game a season. Which, to be fair, he weren't far wrong. We were crap all season. And we were like Real Madrid against Man U last day of the season. And because he was fuming. And because of the scenario where everything was happening at Anfield, where I think Jamie scored for Liverpool against Kenny, who's obviously a Liverpool manager at Anfield. And the scenario there, and Man U win and they beat us. They obviously win the league. And we got a draw, but Ludo was off the charts. Yeah,
unbelievable, wasn't he?
Frightening.
Incredible when you watch those highlights back. So that summer, signed Marco Bugas. And you're the first person I've asked about this.
You've been waiting for someone to ask this to.
Well, I was all right.
Off the back of a videotape.
Yeah, but Bugas was a number nine.
Right, okay.
So I was like, it didn't bother me because I was like, okay, I was anywhere. But he's a madman, isn't he?
Was he any good on the training pitch?
Nah, not really. He didn't like stink the place out or anything. It was just like, he's all right. Nah, he's crap. Yeah, he's all right. And then obviously goes to Old Trafford and was it Boots Gary Neville?
Yeah.
Best thing he's ever done.
Was that Martin Allen in his ear?
Well, yeah, he's Gary Neville because everyone wants to do it. We're all sitting here going, I wish I was Marco Bugas for the day.
But you leave 6 months later, like January 96, you go off to Sheffield United. I've heard this about Harry Redknapp from other players, that he basically has like a 2-year love affair with players generally, and it kind of like you bring in and then he eventually turns. Was that the case with you?
Yeah, we just didn't get on.
At all, ever.
Off the pitch, absolutely. But Harry is very, very, very emotional. Like unbelievable. And obviously I am as well. So you're same sort of characters. And he wanted me to be, and he always used to say, I wish you were like Monks. I wish you were like Bish. Wish you could keep the ball more. And I used to go like, listen, Gaffer, we're obviously saying this in a row. And I go, Gaffer, my job's to get Tony Cotty a couple of goals today. I'm going to risk giving the ball away 15 times today. But if Tony Cotty scores 2 goals and we win, and I get, we didn't call him assists back then. But if I stick him through a couple of times and he scores, we win the game. Happy days. Not asked about my stats. And then his head would come off. You give the ball away. Bish doesn't go. Monks doesn't go. So we ended up just like really clashing. All of the time on the training ground, like all of the time, like every day. But as soon as you went back into the canteen, he was a different person. I was a different person. Loved him. Just football wise.
Football out of it.
And the 2 year thing might be right. We just couldn't stand being together for so long.
Yeah.
And then I made one of the best football decisions of my life, not because I was leaving West Ham, but joined up with Howard Kendall, who then right. I had a manager who was just like top draw.
Yeah.
Top draw. But it was the same to leave because I felt as though like I had unfinished business at West Ham, but I had to leave at the time for me because I was never going to play under Harry.
You had a bit of a weird... So you go off, you went to Sheffield United, you have this five-year spill away from West Ham. One of the things I wanted to cover in that is, of course, your goal for Scotland against England.
Yeah.
Look at the smile on his face.
We walked from the car park into the training ground.
And we won the game.
Two people mentioned it. Yeah. Like,
it must get
in.
Mentioned constantly, does it? It
sort of. When the Scotland England games come up, it's like, it's pretty cool to have, like...
Yeah.
It was an incredible moment. Is that the highlight of your career, would you say?
I'd say playing in a team. We've all had great games. We've all had bad games. But very rarely do you ever play in a game where it's actually really easy. Because every one of the Scotland players dominated every single England player on the night at Wembley. Like, honestly, I can remember. When we lost the game 2-0 at Hampden, there were so many fights going on at the end of the game. It was untrue because Craig Brown was unbelievable at video analysis. And we knew every single player's strengths for England. We knew every single player's weaknesses for England. And we watched tapes and we watched them, right? And every single free kick that England had, right side, it was Beckham. Mm. Every single free kick, left side, Beckham. Every corner, we knew where Tony Adams would be. We knew where Martin Keown or Gareth Southgate or Paul Ince or whoever was playing. We watched tapes and we had written down like a little, not a dossier, but we had like, if Paul Ince goes in the box, this is where he likes to run. Don, make sure you mark him, right? On all the analysis, Paul Scholes never ever went in the box for a wide free kick or a corner. He always stood on the outside of the box. He scores two headers. Walks in at Hampden because he's on the edge of the box. Yeah. And for some unknown reason, he walks into the box and scores two goals. And we were like, who the f*** picked him up? No one.
No one, because
like,
we haven't seen it.
Exactly. He's never done it. On all the tapes that we watch, he never walked into the box.
Wow.
So we knew, and Craig Brown said to us after the game, we'll beat them at Wembley. He said, because they'll f*** themselves at Wembley. Because the England fans are like so demanding. And he said that sort of old school line where 2-0 is a tricky scoreline. I still believe it is, because you don't know how to manage the game if you're 2-0 up. Because do you go and win 3 or 4?
Go and get another one. Or do you sit back?
And they sat back and every single player, I thought, dominated England that night. I thought the lads were amazing.
Fair play to Craig Brown. And he must have been one of the first doing that then, was it? What year was it? Forgive me for
2000, 2001.
Was it?
Yeah, it was UEFA Euro 2000.
So 2000, yeah. Been, yeah. So 99, 2000. Yeah, it was. But he'd done it ever since we were in the squad. If we go and play Hungary, he'd have like, obviously you haven't got footage and analysis on every single player, but he'd have enough, you know, to give you loads of information before he went on the pitch. He was one of the first.
What happened after the game?
Which, at England?
England, when you scored. Winner. Can you remember?
I can. And it's quite emotional, actually, because my old man was a miner and he'd been down the mines for about 35 years. Really tough man, about 6'6", hard as nails. Never seen him cry from my like youth. Never really shook a hand. Just a ruffle of the barn if you'd done well. And somehow he's in the main stand and he blagged his way to the tunnel at Wembley, which is the old school Wembley by the tunnel. And he was there. And like, I'm coming off the pitch. He's like, so he must have left about 10 minutes early to get to like where he needed to be. And he must have just pied like loads of people to get there. And I'm walking in the tunnel, just about to go in the dressing room. And he's there and he puts his arm out, handshake. And as he handshaked, he gripped on for a little bit.
Wow.
A bit too long that he normally grips on for. And a tiny little tear.
Oh,
I was gone.
What a wonderful story.
Broke me. Because I'd never seen him cry ever in my life.
It's like dad's that is back
isn't
then.
It?
My old man was exactly the same.
Broke me.
It was always a solid handshake.
But you know when they keep on for another 10 seconds?
I remember with my dad, sorry, we're talking about yours, but like, do you know when you come off a game as a player and you know you've done all right? So, you know, Don was probably the same, not one for praise. You go up to my old man and go, waiting for that. Yeah, you've done really well today, boy. Brilliant. Never that.
What about
handshake.
The header?
What about this? What about that? Could have done this a bit better.
What about the header that you missed there?
Yeah. Always.
You've got a worldie.
And when you're coming off thinking he's going to say something, and it'd always be, you've done all right.
Done okay, boy.
Yeah.
Oh, but that was going back. That's what Suey was like as a manager.
Yeah.
You know, Suey would give you
Yeah. Martin O'Neill was the same.
Yeah.
Martin O'Neill.
Didn't need it, did you?
No, didn't need it.
Because like you read it and you're like, you know you've made a map. Like a nod.
Oh, that's lovely after the game.
Yeah. Did you got your shirt from that day or anything?
Yeah. I got my shirt and I swapped with Shearer.
Oh, wow.
So Shearer's...
that's good.
Shearer's England.
Framed.
Shirt. Lovely.
Framed.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right, West Ham fans, one way you can support Ironcast and help us rocket up the charts and beat off the competition from other official football clubs podcasts like Chelsea and like Spurs is to get a 5-star rating or review from you. Support me and Ginger on the podcast, chuck us a 5-star rating review and help us rocket up the charts where West Ham belong, at the top of the table. Back on with the show.
So let's talk about your second spell. Like, I was so excited when you came back in 2001 and you joined around the same time as Tommy Repka, David James.
We could have an episode just on Thomas Repka stories,
Give me a Tommy Repka story. Come on.
Tommy Repka. So we had these guys. He used to come to the training ground, come here and clean the lads' cars, 25 quid a pop. So the car park was pretty decent at the time. I had a 550 Maranello. DeCanio hated me. Scotsman driving a Ferrari, it's a disgrace. Like Paolo was fuming. Trev had a, Michael had a Corvette. Michael Carrick had this big black American Corvette thing. I think Trev had a Porsche. J-Mo had an M3 or something. And
A few quid.
Tommy Repka bought a Lamborghini.
I can't remember
which one, like 250 grand a pop Lamborghini. But he's parked it right up against the wall where our changing room was, the porter cabin. So guys used to clean the car. You'd give them like 25 quid to do a decent job. He left it in first gear and the lad turned the key and jumped forward and went through the porter cabin. Bottom end of his Lamborghini is through the porter cabin. Right?
Knowing Tommy Repka, right? He must have been fuming.
Weren't insured. He was insured. The guys who were cleaning the cars weren't insured to drive cars.
Oh,
Tommy had to foot a bill of like, I don't know, 30 grand for a new front end.
Oh, that makes me feel sick.
30 grand for a car wash.
I presume he took that quite well.
30 grand for a car wash.
30 grand for the car wash. £6.50 to sort the porter cabin out.
Oh, Tommy.
Yeah. And that first season when you came back to West Ham, you're a number four.
Yeah.
And like, you're just playing far deeper. And that first season under Glenn Roeder, we were just firing.
Seventh, didn't we?
Finished seventh. It just felt like... this is really the beginning of something with lads like Joe Cole coming through and eventually Glenn Johnson, but Michael
Canute, DeCanio, Defoe, Trevor Sinclair.
You were saying that's a top four team, you think, maybe?
I think modern day managers, I think, would have that team close to top four.
Yeah. What if you took Guardiola now and popped him in?
So David James in goal. Right. Thomas Repka, Christian Daly. I think Nigel Winterburn was at left back. Your midfield of Joey Cole, Michael Carrick, Trevor Sinclair.
Yourself.
If I get in. DeCanio, Canute, Defoe. I mean, it's close, isn't it?
Yeah, it's unreal.
It's close.
But you do your ACL. I think it's in the January first season and you're out for basically a year almost. I think it's January through to December, something like that. And it was against Middlesbrough, right?
It was.
Is it a tackle?
No. So Frank Quadru, who was playing left back, tried to clip a ball Upton Park down the chicken run side. And I've ran over and I've gone to block it like that. And as I've put my studs in the turf, my knee's gone that way and snapped back that way. So it is, you've had ACL, haven't you?
Yeah, done
the
it.
Most,
yeah.
At the time, it was the most brutal rehab I've ever had in my life. Because when you come out the operation, you're there and you're in that sort of like angle. Yeah. And the most important thing coming back from an ACL is they have to push it back. So they have to get your legs back straight. So they'd put like a book and a weight. And then they'd push down and John Green would measure it and go, oh, brilliant today. Got a millimetre today. Millimetre. Like you're biting on like pillows with like pain and they're trying to like push it through and they've got to get it straight. And then the whole mental side of it, trying to come back, going into tackles, all that sort of stuff. It took me ages. I was back probably in about 10 months, 9 months, but it took me a good 11 up there to go into tackles and whip balls again.
How was you in your rehab? Did you struggle? Was it tough? As in mentally wise?
No.
I speak to a lot of boys who've had long-term injuries. Were you all right in the gym every day?
Well, the gym at the time was like the porter cabin downstairs and I had like two windows looking out in the pitch.
You just walked past it on the way in.
I know.
Like you said, you're just sitting
on a bike like that looking out the window for like 9 months of that life, like hard, but like not mentally hard. I think that word these days overused, like the mental side of stuff. It's just hard.
Yeah.
You just roll your sleeves up and get on with it.
I found it I found it easier when I was probably out for the same a year, maybe. I found it easier because of the group of lads we had as well.
Right.
Do you know if the dressing room was good and all that? If he was like Ag coming in every day, it'd be hard, wouldn't it? But I think what got me through it was the lads that were here at the time, that banter in the dressing room, I think.
Yeah. It's difficult because I don't know how you felt, but like you don't want to be a burden to the lads that have got games.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
So like you're going through your own rehab and you know you're not available for like 9 months, 10 months. So the last thing you want to do is be all moping around the first team. So you've got to come in and put a smile on your face because all the lads are coming in to the porter cabin downstairs for like strappings to get ready for training. You can't be sitting there moaning. It's going to bring them down. Mm. So you've got to try and put a brave face on because they've got, and football's quite brutal anyway. They forget you in 5 minutes, don't they? And the lads who are playing and training, they forget you. They just walk past you. But not in a bad way. It's just got a job to do. Mm, it's like, and you don't want it. You don't want some. How are you getting on today? Yeah, I've got 9 months left. Yeah, cheers.
Yeah, cheers for that. I've got a year to go.
8.5 months. Like, you know, you can't crack on, lads. Like, I'm
all right. I'm good.
Yeah.
So the West Ham, so when you get injured, West Ham, that first season, when you're in your second spell, we finished seventh, things are going really well. You're out for 10 months or so. You come back December 2003 and suddenly we're in a relegation battle.
I know.
But you'd spent that time in the kind of physio room coming back to fitness. Like, could you see things changing?
The thing is about football, Ginge will tell you, when you kick off the season, you've got so much hope, right? You're so optimistic that this season's going to be the season. When you're seventh the year before, you think, right, we can kick on, try and get fifth, sixth, fourth, whatever it might be. And then before you know it, you've lost a couple of games, you've drawn a couple of games, you've won a couple of games, not the end of the world, we're halfway in the league. And then before you know it, it's like February, March, and you go, me, we're in the bottom three. Like, you haven't got no time. Like, because I'm looking around and I'm going like, Decanio, Defoe, Canute, Sinclair, Carrick, Cole.
How is this happening?
How has this happened? And then before you know it, another four games have gone by and you're at like the end of March and you're going like, we are in like a proper relegation scrap here. We're going down. Like, we need to get our fingers out. And then like you'd win a game, an unexpected one. And then like, you always think you're going to get out of it. And the teams that are in the bottom three, bottom five, I always say it now in punditry. Like I say, like what you need when you're down there is back-to-back wins. You're down there for a reason because you don't get back-to-back wins.
Yeah.
Because you're not good enough. And whenever you win one, it's the good and the bad. Like when you're in a dressing room, if you're going for something, if you're going for a title, or you're going for like top four, or if you're in the bottom three, the first thing you do, you'll back me up on this, is when you come in at Upton Park or the new stadium, first thing you do is you bang on the telly and see the results from elsewhere.
Yeah.
Because if you win and everyone else wins, pointless.
Yeah.
But if you win and everyone loses, you go...
You'd be buzzing.
Yeah, and then when you've lost the game,
results went for you.
And then you've lost the game, and everyone else has lost, and you go, oh, "What result that was?"
Mm. Got away with it.
Yeah.
So sorry to interrupt you. We had Bo on, didn't we? Yeah. From the same time, Lee Bowyer was on, who was at the club at the
great
time.
Great lad.
He felt like he could. He didn't know. Like looking at the squad, he couldn't get why he was down there, but he felt he could see, like maybe in the background, like sort of around the training ground. Maybe when he came, he didn't think it was. What's the word I'm looking for?
Like, it was a bit loose.
A bit loose. Things are a bit loose. Not as professional as it should have been for the squad you had at the time.
I think he's being kind there. Do you know what? Our squad wasn't made up of like massive egos, but like it was very talented and everyone's like vying for like positions or everybody's vying for like the alpha male in the dressing room. Mm. And it wasn't like a bad scenario. It was like an amazing group of lads to be with. But I think Bo's probably got it spot on where it was very, very loose. Discipline was loose. So when Glenn Rhoda was in charge, he saw it, Glenn. Glenn was a very, very intelligent guy. And he saw how loose we were. And he tried to put things in place, i.e. brought chef in, Tim Diath, who was like different class with the food. He had TVs put downstairs because he was obsessed with the lads training and everyone just going home. So he wanted the lads to stay behind, have a chat, spend a bit of time, bond a little bit. You got the telly on, you can have a chat, the food's good. And Paolo, I got on really well with Paolo. Paolo was like a brilliant lad, but like just so up and down, it was untrue. So when Glenn put no mobile phones downstairs was allowed, your phones get switched off in the dressing room, leave your phones behind. So the next day, Paolo comes in. I promise you, he had a pair of Dolce & Gabbana sunglasses on. One said on that side, one said off on that side. He came in on his Vespa, parked it in Glenn's space and come in on his phone. Like he broke every rule that was just being put in place, right? And he wrecked the morning. And one of my biggest regrets for Glenn was not chinning Paolo at Chad Waleef on a particular day. Because Glenn put a session on, top pitch by the houses, and it was midfield players get it, ping it out to wide men. Trevor Sinclair would cross it. Front men get in the box, finish it. Yeah. Quite a basic skill. Paolo, not play number nine today. Paolo want to be a midfield player. So Glenn's gone, okay, Paolo, you drill it out there. He's got it out of his feet. He's drilled it 20 yards too heavy into the gardens. Lost ball. So I can't spit off. It's not like Paolo. Do the session again. Ball, lost ball. Again. Right, messing the session up.
Was it just
because it was Paolo, he had his head on.
Yeah, he was just at the... Just had his head on. That's Paolo came in that mood.
Yeah, exactly. So Glenn said, if you're not going to do the session, get yourself in. Paolo, come in. Right, I should have chinned him. Looking back, would have been the right thing to do. And then he's gone. You hear his Vespa screech out like the car park and he's off, like a little hairdryer. Comes back in the next day.
Good as gold. Yeah.
Right, baked you a tiramisu cake. Paolo baked a tiramisu cake, put it on there and went, Paolo, really sorry about yesterday. Happy as Larry. Like, just up, down. That's how sort of loose the dressing room was.
Talk about players like that. I think they're all a bit like that, aren't they? They got to have something a bit different,
a bit
different about him to be that.
I mean, I've got no idea what you put in the cake. But it was decent.
But then as a squad, you are like, I've played with players probably not as bad as that.
You carry that though.
Yeah, but you take it, wouldn't you? As long as they're doing it on a Saturday, and nine times out of ten, Paolo was.
I got on really well with him. Like I said, when I'd done my ACL, he had an injury. I can't remember what it was. Kept him out for about a month and a half, and we were like literally on the treadmill next to each other. Like a bit like what Julian, what I was saying with Julian, where Paolo didn't really let anyone in. Mm. He was so open, but like he was so like strange and so like left field and off the cuff. You couldn't really get in with Paolo. And when you spend a bit of time with him, like I did in the treatment room, good lad.
Yeah,
just talk emotional.
We go down. You're one of the few, I would say, Premier League quality players who stick around in a summer where every week it just feels like there's a player leaving all the time. What was that period like to have come through?
Horrible. I seen some footage on telly the other day. It was like old footage, not of West Ham, just about a team going down. No, actually it was West Ham. And it was Joey Cole coming off in tears. And the worst experience I've ever had in football is getting relegated. Mm. You been down?
No.
It's soul destroying. It's horrible. You feel like gutless. You've got nothing inside of you. You want to cry. Fans, you look and all the fans are in tears. And the bit that I saw on the telly the other day, the commentator said, and it was Joe Cole going off, he went, some of these West Ham players will never make it back to the Premier League or never play in the Premier League next season. They won't make it back for next season. And like you hear it and you go, that's actually really true. Mm. Like you never know if you're going to come back. It's horrible. It's like
that's for everyone at a club though, Don, isn't it?
Yeah.
When a club goes down, especially that sort of time.
Absolutely. That's what people working at a club.
I spoke about it before and I speak about it all the time. 2007, I remember feeling a real burden of people getting around the training ground getting sacked and stuff like that.
It's horrible.
So it is. Yeah. It's almost being relegated. It's a horrendous feeling.
And then we had that season, the Championship. We get to the playoff final against Palace. We're 1-0 down, 16 minutes left. Glenn turns to the bench and says, oh no, who would it have been?
Pardew.
Pardew turns to the bench and says, Don, save us.
He didn't actually say that because we hated each other. So there's no way he'd have said to me, Don, save us. It was probably the last throw of the dice. And I don't think it was 16. It felt like about six. Apparently, I think Ian Dowie was the Palace manager. And apparently the Palace players knew they'd beat us before the game started because Pardew made us wear, not made us wear, because we looked $1 million, actually. We looked the and we had socks on perfect, shorts perfect, top on, and a tracksuit top.
Yeah.
Like we are West Ham or something on the back.
Yeah.
Like something like, and Palace, like Ragos Rovers, socks down, like Michael Hughes, Ian Dowie, like all young kids, Neil Shipley, guys that just look like a bag of and we're standing there looking $1 million and they thought, look at these.
We got these
we
today.
We got these. Look at these flash West Ham players. Like, look at them. They've done us 1-0.
Oh,
it's terrible.
Bleak day. But we came out the season after.
Preston?
And that was the summer you left as West Ham, kind of got back to the Premier League, that completed your journey. But your West Ham journey continues to this day. Conference League final, whenever I watch the highlights back, which is at least once a week, I get to hear your voice, Don. Your commentary in Prague alongside Robbie Savage. What was it like? How was it for you?
It was amazing. It was like, because I didn't feel for the players on the pitch in terms of what they'd done. I got more the sense of what the West Ham fans in the stadium had been through my days. Yeah. Disappointment, like rejection, like relegation. So seeing like grown men, women like cry in their sort of like whatever, 50s, 60s, you know they've been through the 90s football. So that's what got it for me. And the scene when the final whistle went, when Moisey ran across, I think, to see his old man in the corner. I can remember saying on commentary, because we were all sort of chatting, and I remember like having a little meeting between Adam Summit and the commentator, Robbie Savage, and myself. And it was like three of us on comms. And I was kind of like, lads today, like, let's not just jabber on. Let's just like hardly speak, because everyone watching the game, they've not tuned in for us three. Let the pitchers tell a story. And I remember like Robbie like delivering his line, like, look at David Moyes, like what it means for him. And then when Adam sort of threw to me, I went, if you don't mind, Adam, I'm not going to say anything, because I can't do any justice to watching Moyes run across the elation on his face. I'm just going to keep quiet and watch it. And a lot of people have sort of said that was like a really nice thing to do.
Oh,
but it was more. But it was more definitely for the fans of the 90s and the noughties of relegations and seeing crap footy and fight football, as I said before, and then go and win a European trophy.
Oh.
Amazing.
So would you consider yourself a West Ham fan? Is it West Ham still
in
your heart?
I do. I mean, I'm a Newcastle fan at heart, because I stood on the Gallagher end when I was a kid, when I was like 10, 11, 12, before I sort of got into it. But two spells at West Ham, like, you saw my face when I drove in here and like looking at the pitches and going, like the pitch on the left-hand side by the car park, Harry had that as a mud pitch. So he left it muddy on purpose. So when it rained, like a quagmire, so like your legs were like burning, like you're like diving like slidey tackles and mud all over your face and like scruffy and dirty. And it's like brilliant times. Amazing times.
Are you? I speak about it a lot. Are you similar to certainly me and a lot of the old boys I speak to? Do you still feel like you've got a real affiliation with West Ham? I think it's something, I've said it loads of times on here. When you play for this club, there's something about, you speak to all the older boys who played before me and since me, everyone's still got that feeling for the club. And I don't think anyone can
Everton's
really
the same, you know.
Yeah.
Everton draws you in. You know, like, I've been lucky. I've played for like Liverpool and Sunderland. I've played for some fantastic clubs. But I think Everton and West Ham are very similar in terms of what they've been through, size of the football club. No one around the world, when they look at Man City or Man United and they call them the biggest clubs in the world, no one's got a gist or a clue how big West Ham are and how big Everton are. And that's another side of it, where you want them to be great again, because the fans of the 70s have saw it and saw how good they were and the legendary names. It's like you want them to be that good again, just to remind everyone. Clubs like West Ham can try and get back to the top because of the history and the heritage that they've got.
I hate to mention this, but when you left West Ham after your second spell, you were in Millwall. Did you get that? Did you get that feeling there?
From a high straight to you went to Millwall.
You didn't get that sense.
Why every day in training? Why don't you F-bot back to West Ham? You
did every, you get it?
Every, so, mate, did every you? Day. Big
what off the players?
No,
the fans.
Fans. Right. Every day or every match day. We play a game and I used to get slaughtered every single game. It's fine, is what it is. And by my car, there's like five heavy dudes like standing there, language, hey, get back to West Ham, you this, that, and the other. And I was like, I think I need to leave here. Like, might be a good idea to leave. I'll tell you the reason why I signed is because I was going through a divorce at the time. And my lad, Max, who was about sort of 6 or 7, I had offers to go and play in America and Australia. And the only reason I went to Millwall, it was because it was the only offer that I could stay in the house that, or the flat that he had in Repton Park, and I could be local. And it was like a move. It was never going to work, but I didn't want to go to Australia and be away from my lad, or the MLS and be away from my lad. So I went there, and I literally was there for about 4 months, and Adrian Heath was up at Coventry, and I went, Inchy, get me out of here, mate. I'm going to die here. They're going to kill me. So I went to Cov.
We accept your alibi on behalf of West Ham.
It's true. Whenever people say like the clubs you play for, I never say Millwall.
Oh, you know,
I just blank it.
Never mention it.
Never blank it. Never happened.
All right, Don, I've absolutely loved this chat, but we're going to end with our brand new feature, which is Mystery Player. Now, Ginge struggled last week.
Come on, Ginge.
You say struggled. I got it in three questions.
Well, look.
Is that struggling, is it?
In my book, yeah. But this week, we've got your
it's
help.
It's not going to go any better, so...
Are we a team?
We've got you. So you're a team. You're on the same team now, okay? Six clues. You've got to name the player. He's a ex-West Ham. And he did play with you both. He played with you both. Ooh. Clue number one, I was born in Hampstead, London on August 25th, 1979.
79.
August baby, born in Hampstead, 1979.
79, what's that make him? 34-ish?
Yeah.
That's all I know.
What, 44?
44.
Yeah.
Just a decade.
He'd still be playing. He'd still be playing,
yeah. Doesn't bode well for the rest of this quiz.
Born in Hampstead in 1975.
Hampstead. 1979.
1979.
I don't even know where Hampstead is.
Only a couple of years, he's only a couple of years older than me.
All right,
I'm not getting it from that.
I've got no idea.
I began my career with Nottingham Forest.
Marlon Harewood.
Oh, Don's done it. Don's done it.
I was gonna go Teddy Sheringham, but he's definitely older than that, Ted.
Don, Marlon. Don, unreal.
There you
Marlon
go.
Harewood.
After two clips. Well done, Don. Fantastic stuff. Here's the rest of the clues if you want to play along at home. I've played for clubs in Finland, China, and England.
Well, I wouldn't have got off Finland.
Finland?
Yeah, Finland?
Yeah, I think
who did talent. He play for
Finland
in Finland?
China. He's had more clubs than Nick Faldo or Marlon.
You should have done Finland and China before that one. Yeah. We'd never got it.
I rejected an international call-up from Barbados in 2008. After retiring, I went into a business customising cars. According to my Instagram, I'm a dad, entrepreneur and sports personality.
I knew that was going to get a mention.
And a good lad.
I think so. A good lad.
That was on a cut last week, that post on his Instagram. I think he's been hacked. I mean, you don't put that on your own Instagram. Sports personality.
Check
sports
the spelling.
Yeah. I mean...
If you spelled it wrong, he's put it on.
Yeah. Don, thank you so much for this chat and thank you for the memories down the years. You had such a great... Oh, man, you had the teams you were in and the times you provided us.
Brilliant.
Fantastic
Cheers,
stuff.
Cheers, Don. Thanks, mate.
And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time on Ironcast. Until then, come on, you Irons.
Podcast Network.